Listen, we've been talking all year about what it means to be driven for Jesus and what it takes to live a faith that is unashamed. The antithesis of being driven is mediocrity. It's been said that no one chooses mediocrity, but many settle for it. If you ask me what plagues the modern church in America, I would say that it is the contentment with being average, being good enough, as if being good enough is even a thing. Mediocrity is a pursuit of non-excellence, it's a deflection of personal responsibility for the state and condition of the kingdom. Mediocrity is defined as the quality of being average, a state of being moderate, commonplace, halfway to your potential. It's not the worst, but it's the best of the least. And here is the problem with mediocrity in Christendom. It's that we begin to think that we can give some of our life to God when God gave all of his life to us. It is a partial commitment in a covenant that demands full commitment. This is how things like service and sacrifice and generosity become optional for Christians. The difference between mediocrity and excellence in the local church hinges upon the collision of the power of the Holy Spirit and the dogged determination of those who are called by his name. A healthy church driven by community always, always purges out mediocrity. It will not tolerate partial commitments. I think the same is true for healthy families and organizations. And I believe that when we are driven by community, everybody gets better. When we're driven by community, unity is a bigger deal. Leading with what is best for my neighbor and for someone else is a bigger deal. And quite frankly, it's where the accountability to live like Christ gets its traction is in community. Somebody sent me this cute video clip about 3 weeks ago. I thought it was perfect for today. I know this is a lot of video clips in your day today, but we're going to share it anyway. So let's just go ahead and run that. It's just smarter to travel in groups. Listen, the Bible is all about community. It's the story of a triune God who creates a man and woman in his image and then gives birth to the family. This same God resides inside a monotheistic nation of people to carry his story of ultimate redemption all the way to the ends of the earth through his son, Jesus Christ, who upon arriving here to begin his ministry, starts by choosing 12 to work with. And this community will one day infect the entire world with his grace. And it would literally ripple out for generations to come. From one came millions. It's the ripple effect of God across all of eternity. Listen, community is all over this book. Other than Samson, there are no Lone Rangers in this book. And if you remember the story well, it does not go well for Samson. Samson needed a group and a covenant group and all that. It did not go well for him. Somebody needed to speak into Samson's life. Don't go there, bro. Don't go there. Don't touch that. All right. Every Old Testament prophet railed against the disintegration and disobedience of God's beloved community. So we're going to look at two passages this morning of Scripture. I'm going to share them with you. Go to the book of Ecclesiastes, and then we're going to go to Philippians. Both Old and New has a picture of what community looks like. In chapter 4, book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon writes this. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For who am I toiling, he asked? For why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up, but pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands, any two people wrapped around the person of Jesus Christ is not quickly broken. Go to the book of Philippians. Paul writes to the church, chapter 2, verse 1. He says, therefore, if any of you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my love complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in the spirit and of one mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interest, but each of you to the interest of the others. This is what community looks like. The fact is that mass creates momentum, that we can do more together than apart, that in this kind of community, no man or woman is ever left behind. We believe in a community where it is a place to belong and a place to become. We believe that shared joy is a double joy and shared sorrow is half a sorrow. We believe the love of God and the love of our neighbor is the same thing, and they are intertwined and they are not separable. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 12, he says, just as a body, though one has many parts, but all of its parts form one body, so it is with Christ. For we are all baptized with one spirit, so as to form one body. Whether Jews or Gentiles, slave or free, we are all given one spirit to drink. Even so, the body is not made up of one part, but of many. What Paul is trying to say is that for the kingdom to advance, for us to break the chains of brokenness, if we're going to be darkness repelling light, then it's going to take all of us, and it's going to take us moving together, moving as one. The benefits of genuine, authentic community seem so obvious, yet examples in real life seem so hard to find. Listen, I love our church. I love what we stand for. I love that we laugh together and cry together. I love how we touch the lives of so many. I love how we fight for each other. And I love being in here on Sundays. Now, what I'm about to say is not going to shock anybody. It's not going to surprise you. But honestly, I don't know why everyone isn't here with us who says that Georgiana is their family if they're not sick or out of town. I don't get it. I'm not ever going to get it. I don't say that because I'm your pastor. I say it because I love our church, and I love to be with Jesus and the Spirit and all of us together. What if the consequences of not being here on Sunday had nothing to do with disappointing God? What if it had nothing to do with what you might not get out of it or what you might miss, but actually had something to do with the fact that God had something in mind for you by being here that you weren't able to accomplish because you did not come? What if there's someone in the room that needs you, needed to sit near you, needed to speak to you, needed to hear from you, needed to be encouraged by you, and you chose not to be here? And the work of God that God intended to pass through you on this day did not happen because you were tired and wanted to sleep in. Or you had a better offer. It happens. I'm telling you, it happens. Listen, most Saturdays, I can hardly sleep in anticipation of being here on Sundays. Most Saturdays, I don't sleep, partly because of the Gators. But I mean, last night was not one of those nights, can we have thank you, Jesus, right? So, but you know, it was one of those things in anticipation to be here. I lay in bed at night and I think about you, and I think about the sermon, and I think about worship, and I think about the music, and I play it in my head, and it just goes through the whole thing. I can hardly sleep because I don't want to miss this. I don't want to miss being here with you all. To quote a country song, you're the only people who've laughed all day. I thought that was funny, and nobody laughed all day. You are my people. We ain't always pretty, but we're real. And I wouldn't have it any other way, right? So those of you who know me well, I mean, Rashad and I did it earlier in the hallway. Those of you who know me well, I'm a hugger. I'm a hugger by nature. You should be warned. In the early church, Christians greeted one another when they saw them with a holy kiss. Makes looking being a hugger not as bad, right? Right, that's looking at some of you are like, we ain't doing that kiss thing, are we? I mean, look, barely tolerate the hugging thing. So listen, the church should be a safe place for love and affection. And sadly, throughout history, it has not always been so. So at Georgiana, we work extra hard to make sure our church is a safe place for all of God's children, because we really do believe that the hallmark of a healthy church is love and affection. Listen, I know not everyone is a hugger, right? And you should declare that when you walk up to me. But what if the only time someone ever feels loved and valued is in this room when they're hugged by another human being? What if that's the only time someone feels like they have infinite worth? It's because somebody wasn't afraid to hug them and tell them that they love them. I know this is a reality in this room because I hear from you. I hear from people who say, on Sundays is the only morning anybody ever hugs me, and it just means the world to me. I want to share a picture. I talk all the time about my accountability partners. Let me share a picture of them right there. This is my life-giving accountability group. I'm the good-looking one in the middle. You're starting to see a common hairstyle. The longer we're together, we begin to look more alike. These are my guys. These are the guys that I go to war with. These are the guys that I battle with. The fact is that we are all very different. We range in age from 40 to 60. We are wildly different in our approaches to ministry, but we are united around Jesus Christ as the one thing that drives us together. When we first started meeting, it freaked them out that I told them that I loved them and I wanted to hug them. They were weird with that. I mean, it was just, you know, I'd be on the phone with them, go, "Hey, man, Jeremy, I love you," and it'd be like this awkward silence. "Oh, yeah, okay. I mean, right, you know." So it's, I mean, you've heard me say, I mean, I don't want to leave anybody confused. If I love you, I want you to know I love you, and I'm going to tell you that I love you. I think this is the way the world ought to operate. A couple of them did not see this as a good idea. They didn't see it as very manly, all this expression of loving and touching and hugging. And it was like, you know, it was kind of outside their comfort zone. And you know me, my man card is non-existent. I do not care. I'm not dinging my man card in this. I just kept forcing the issue. It's a true story. If one of them said goodbye to me on the phone and hung up after I had told them that I loved them and they didn't reciprocate, I called them immediately back and said, hey, dude, you forgot to tell me that you love me. "Oh, yeah, man, I love you, man, I love you." Right? I just kind of forced the issue, right? You know, Dee Dee will, I drive them nuts with this. Dee Dee doesn't know why I have not been ejected and replaced in my peer group. She doesn't understand why they put up with it. All, as that is said, you know, listen, it's, when we're together and we get ready to leave for a long time, it was just awkward because they knew what was coming. Oh, man, you know, we would pray together and we'd cry together, but we'd get ready to say goodbye, and it meant that you were going to have to be transparent with me because I was going to hug you for a long time, right? And some of them needed some encouragement, like, because they're not all huggers. Next slide. So you have to tough love them. Sometimes you have to say to them, "You will not leave me. You will not go until I have hugged you." And sometimes you have to sneak up on them. That's what it is. Now, listen, I know not everyone is a hugger. I have some staff members who are not big on hugging. We treat them like they have leprosy. Just kidding. We wave at them. We wave at them, right? Nathan, on the other hand, loves to be hugged. He is a huge hugger, so when you see him later today, give him a squeeze. He would love that. He would love that. He's already just crawling with enthusiasm at what might happen, right? Listen, I've discovered in life, there's three types of hugs in life. There's the sports hug. We all know that hug, you know, where you kind of slap a hand, bring it in. One slap. Just one slap. Boom. Right? And then you break. Right? It's a favorite among men. Boom, 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 out. Right? Tap it out. Right? Then there's holy hugs. Christian people don't know what to do about hugs because there's all these boundary issues. So it's kind of a side hug. Right? You don't make eye contact. You just kind of hug them from the side. Lots of free boundary issues. All good. And then there are big honking hugs. These are the favorite of overhuggers. You know overhuggers, right? These are the kind of hugs that say, "Man, I really love you." But the key is not to stay too long or to linger. That's the key. So you have to do 3 to 5 pats. 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, break. We're good. In there and out of there. Now, research will tell us that hugs release endorphins and feel-good hormones that actually are good for our health. But research also tells us that in order to reach these hormone-releasing levels, the hug must last at least 20 seconds. Some of you right now, your skin is crawling just thinking about this. I mean, you're just really uncomfortable right now. So let's be honest. 20 seconds no longer feels like hugging. Feels a little bit more like cuddling. Right? I mean, that's a long time, right? I mean, I timed it the other day, not with anybody, I want to point that out. I mean, my own wife doesn't want to hug for 20 seconds. I timed 20 seconds the other night, I thought, yeah, that's awkward. That's awkward, but in science, you can't deny the science. You know, you hug for 20 seconds, you get done with that, you don't know, do I owe you dinner? Do I, you know, it's like, I don't know, you know, it's like, do we have to go out? I mean, it's our second date. I mean, this kind of thing, right? So the key to successful hugging is a timely release. I'll let you all decide what's appropriate for you as a timely release. I'm just arguing that love and affection is what set the early church apart as part of being a healthy community and family. And it ought to be okay, right? So just, you know, if that's not you, that's not you. Just declare it when you see somebody coming. Not a hugger, not a hugger. It's like in the early days when you had leprosy, you shouted unclean when you walked through the building. Just shout, ugling, ugling. It's what you do. Listen. Listen, I believe culture has been tearing at the fabric of community for centuries, minimizing it and promoting isolationism. Technology, the very thing designed to connect us, has become the great isolator. Did you know the average screen time of American people now is about 10 hours and 39 minutes? That's the average screen time for most Americans. This means if you get 7 hours of sleep a night, then you only have 6 hours remaining dedicated to meaningful vocational, recreational, relational, and spiritual endeavors. I'm not a math major, but it doesn't add up to much productivity in those four areas. We also live in an age of compartmentalization. I have my church friends and I have my party friends, and even though it's compromising, sometimes they're the same community. I have my family and I have my peer group at work, and somewhere along the way, while these two things coexist, we've lost the ability to be transparent. We have shifting identities among many communities. We have more communities than ever, but less commitment to any of them. Let me share this quote. I think you'll find this surprising. It is appalling, the quote says, it is appallingly obvious that our technology has exceeded our humanity. Any guess who said that? Our technology has exceeded our humanity? Albert Einstein, 1925. 1925, he said that. Can you imagine what he would think if he were living in the world today? Modern technology is absolute control over our lives. Nowadays, we work, love, shop, play, communicate with each other, and world online. We've embraced advanced technology, seeking only the benefits while completely ignoring the downfalls. The social impact of technology is huge because today we spend more time online than any other time before in history, and it plays an incredible role in our lives. And there's no doubt that modern technology has better facilitated our lives and our communication with the world. I mean, we're able to call the orphanage in Haiti. Sometimes we're able to FaceTime. I mean, it's been a blessing. But there's also some visible flaws. Now, this is a short list that I created. You could create your own list. But here's some concerns I have. I think it wastes time. Time is precious. It's a precious commodity that we do not get any more of. And when it's gone, it's gone. And we are all spending way too much time looking at a screen, not looking around, not looking at God's creation. We're looking at trivial, meaningless information about the Kardashians, all right? I mean, just give that up, right? I mean, nobody cares. Nobody cares. Secondly, I think it's a threat to our emotional and physical health. The level of inactivity associated with smart devices is through the roof in our culture today. It has been associated with older sedentary diseases that you find in much, much older people. It's actually dropped the average life expectancy in this country in the last 5 years by almost a year and a half. It's also a place where you can inadvertently invite criticism, bullying, and pain right into your life. It's why I don't Facebook, I don't tweet, and I don't Instapot. I don't do any of those things. Is that not what it is? I don't know what it is. I don't do it. Whatever it is, I don't do it. Number three, I think there's a lack of privacy. We invite total strangers into the most intimate knowledge of our life just by what we put online, by what we show online, pictures of our kids, pictures of our vacations. The whole thieving world knows when you're on vacation and knows where you live, right? We just invite them. You might as well leave the door unlocked so they don't break it, right? I mean, literally. We have the stress to stay current. The fear of missing out, the fear of being left out consumes our culture. Sometimes it's actually best just not to know what everybody else is doing. And for sure, not everybody needs to know what you're doing. Number five, it provides a platform of hate. Do I need to say anything more about that? Never before in the history of mankind has it been so easy to hate other people and to throw grenades and not live in the collateral damage you create. It's ugly and it's awful. And lastly is isolationism. This may be the worst thing. The Bible is correct when it said it was not good for man to be alone. And technology has dwarfed social skills and minimized relational dependency and is a leading cause of increased suicide rates. The fact is that we're not only dependent on technology, we're addicted to it. About 3 years ago, I'm happy to share my failures with you. About 3 years ago, I invited the church at Simple Christmas to go on a weekend of e-Sabbath. Remember that? We were just going to take the weekend off. We're going to unplug on Friday at 5 and not plug back in until Monday morning at 8. The most email I've ever received in my lifetime was after that weekend. Hundreds, not tens, hundreds of emails about why you couldn't do that. As if I was somehow going to know, right? That God had given me supernatural ability to know that you hadn't unplugged. But you felt the need to defend it. You know what this is called? It's called an addiction. And you couldn't unplug for a weekend. In the name of Jesus, you couldn't unplug. Many studies have shown that when smartphones are taken away, people still heard and felt the vibrations that weren't there. They become nervous and restless and agitated, which are all the signs and symptoms of withdrawal from drugs. The advent of working from home was deemed as a technological wonder, allowing flexible work environments and hours. However, this has now led to increased depression from isolation, increased work hours because it's always in front of you, and the social deprivation of relational skills. Listen, as a guy that's on call 24/7, and I get how hard it is to set it down, how hard it is to put the phone away, how hard it is to turn it off. I get it. But listen, once upon a time, we had meaning. We mattered. We knew we had meaning because we had a mom and a dad who told us so, a God who loved us, and a community who needed us. Once upon a time, if something bad or significant happened to you in your life, there would be a number of people that would mourn for you, not because you were a good person or a good friend, but simply because you were a part of a community, and when one part of the community suffered, the whole community suffered. They didn't have to know you personally, they just were in it with you. Now, very few people can count on one hand the number of people that will mourn their passing. I mean, for example, last week, none of y'all mourned my passing, and it hadn't even happened yet, right? Right? This is why so many people can claim that no one cares about them, that their gifts are minimized, that they feel replaceable and disposable. They can't see God at work, and all of it because they have no true community. Our culture has devalued the communities that had been the bedrock of our nation's stability and the glue that held people together. There's a disregard from any kind of authority in our schools, in our town squares, in our homes, and in our churches. Autonomy and independence and the general disregard for our neighbor is the new normal. As long as I get mine, I don't care what you get, is the new mantra of today's culture. How's that working for us, ignoring our neighbors? We've said for several years that Georgiana is a place to belong and a place to become. And I believe a beautiful community helps people discover their divine identity. It's a place that creates a hunger and a thirst for God. It's a place where pain can be shared and forgiveness is not just a theory. It's a place where fear and doubt can be wrestled with. It's a place that pushes back against darkness. It's a place that prevents hiding and impacts our personal salvation. I love the passage in Hosea that says, "One day I will hear God say, 'You are my people,' and we will say, 'You are our God.'" You see, there are clubs and teams and organizations that can give you a place to belong, but the divine community of church is the only one that can help you become something. It is the only one who can help you become who God created you to be. I want to be very clear that I do not believe there's one simple formula for reaching this healthy community. I think it'll look different for every one of us in the room. But I do believe that community to be truly radiant only happens when it has a sense of urgency for the cause of Christ, when we're driven to be together. I believe you and I are the voices that will speak God's loving truth into our community, and the community of Christ happens when we become one in mission and purpose. It happens when we can't imagine someone living without the saving grace of Jesus Christ and the love of mighty God. It happens when we share what we love. Listen, church, in order for someone to receive, someone has to give. In order for someone to be fed, someone has to provide the food. In order for someone else to benefit, someone else has to sacrifice. This is the work of Christian community. Intermingle together, meeting the needs of one another. All right, so I'm going to close with this. We're going to invite the choir to start making their way to the stage, Misty, and I'll just close with this. When you're struggling, when you're hurting, when you're wounded, limping and doubting, when you're a moment away from a relapse and somebody comes alongside you and they hurt with you and they stand with you and they love you without judgment or condemnation, this is the ministry of I Am Here. This is the ministry of I Am Here. It's what Jesus demonstrated on the cross. He said, "I am here." It's why the Holy Spirit was left in his place, so that we would know that Jesus is always here. Our community is not a brand, it's not a trend, it's not a marketing strategy. It is a Spirit-led way of life, a place where Jesus and the people called by his name shout to the community, "We are here. We are here." The church is not a center for religious goods and services where people pay a fee and receive a product. The church is not an organization that looks into its community and asks, "What can you do for us?" A church is not a sanctuary for assimilation. The church is the only organization in the world that exists for the benefit of those who are not sitting in the room today. We don't make anything. We are dispensers of holy love. When I got to Georgiana, I began to preach the need for an Acts 2 unity in everything we do. And over the years, we've discovered that that's not for everyone. There's some huggers, non-huggers. I mean, it's not for everyone. However, for those who've stayed and those who've been committed to anchor their lives in a healthy church, you've discovered what it looks like. It's become something we could both trust and believe in. It's a place where everyone matters and everyone is needed to be all in. It's a place where we can stand hand in hand, heart in heart, and face a broken, hurting world with the love of Jesus Christ. There are people that call me naive and Pollyannish in my relentless pursuit of this way of living, but I refuse to believe anything less for the beautiful community of God than that. I won't give up doing that. And yet the author of Hebrews told us to not give up worship as some are in the habit of doing. So it's my job as your shepherd to remind you, don't quit. Don't give up gathering. There was a time in early Christian history that your family and your church family were the same thing. You could not separate one from another. It's why the Bible uses terms like brothers and sisters. They were seen as the same group. No compartmentalization, just one for all and all for one. What if God wanted to do it again? What if God's looking into our country today and says, "Listen, I want to do that thing again, the thing that in Acts 2, when everybody was together and everybody was united and nobody cared where you were from or who you were or where you were born, but you were just together"? Listen, our community begins in here and ripples out into Central Brevard. From the elementary school of Cambridge through Cocoa to dozens of college campuses to Kentucky, where a mission team will go this week, to Belize and Guatemala and Kenya and Haiti, right, to Kathy Trembley, who's the teacher of the year at Merritt Island High School. All of these things, we're rippling out. You see, when you're driven by community, there are no boundaries to where God can take you, and there is no limit to who is welcome. Everyone is welcome. Our community is not compartmentalized by age or gender or race or money or status. We are all equally necessary in the great, beloved, beautiful community that is God. May we be that community this day and every day.